Welcome to the Ladies with Gumption. We recap DCTV in a flash. You are listening to episode 48, The Compensation Theory. I am May, and I am here with
Tatiana
and Jessica.
And you can contact us on Twitter at DCTV Gumption. Send your lovely thoughts to our email at ladieswgumption@gmail.com. Send in asks. We are also over on Tumblr at ladieswgumption.tumblr.com, where you can send in your asks. And you can listen to our podcast on iTunes and Google Play as well. We did have some feedback from last week. One Anon wants our take on Carlos at San Diego Comic Con. So what do we think about Carlos and his I don't give a fuck attitude?
Is that really where we're beginning?
That is what we have.
I think that he enjoys playing the role of the person that doesn't give a fuck. Like, that's sort of his thing, right? Like, Tom's is to, like, go around in circles and not answer any questions in a very hyper way. And then Carlos's is, like, to not give a fuck. So
the opposite of hyper.
Exactly. He's like the anti-Tom, or Tom's the anti-Carlos.
I think he was playing his role a little bit too well. I do agree with Anon that this year seemed a little bit different. Like, he just was, like, extra, didn't give a fuck. And, I mean, the way I thought about it, and I didn't really think that much about it, because I just figured Carlos is Carlos. But also, you know, it's not like he has a storyline. The SDCC is a lot of press, and a lot of it's crazy. There's a lot of people. It's hot. As well. So, I mean, I don't really think there's anything kind of sinister behind the scenes or whatever. I think it's just a combination of Carlos likes to be sarcastic, and then also, you know, San Diego Comic-Con is just, like, the hottest mess of a con ever. So, you know, for true. An introvert, it's just, like, your nightmare.
Yeah. True.
Yeah. I agree with that. And my first initial reaction, because I was watching, I was like, oh, he usually has the sunglasses on, but this year he had them on for longer periods of time.
Mm-hmm.
And my first thought was, is he hungover?
It's also possible.
Like, deal with what's going on?
Also possible that he was hungover. I mean, like, I'd never done the Flash press room before, so I can't compare how his demeanor was in interviews to previous ones. But I feel like, just based on videos, it was even more, like, aggressively not answering questions this year, so.
Yeah, I think he really stopped giving two shits, and I know that he's never really liked San Diego Comic Con at all, so maybe this is the year that he's just like, you know what, I've been on this show long enough, and I just don't give a fuck.
Right.
Any other hot takes?
that probably sums it up.
All right. KJ over on Twitter would have liked us to discuss the friendships between the ladies across the shows from last week, which is fair, but we did discuss.
We would have liked to if there were any.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I know we discussed briefly about Iris and Felicity's crossover relationship, but like you said, there isn't enough interaction across the shows for us to. And we know they're so sparse on the shows themselves. So on the crossovers, I feel like the women interact with guys. Like, even Supergirl, she interacts mostly with Barry and Oliver, and she doesn't really interact with the other women. So hopefully that can change this crossover, and we'll have something to discuss.
Yeah, I mean, I guess you could mention Alex and Sarah developed a nice dynamic in the crossover this year, even though it was preceded by a one-night stand. But they had some good conversations about past relationships, and that's...
Exactly.
That happened, and now they don't know each other.
But it only happens for that one moment.
Exactly.
There's no, like, through lines of, you know, oh, I talked to Iris on the phone last weekend, or oh, I talked to Felicity or Caitlin or, you know, Sarah. I can't catch her on the Wave Rider. You know, any of those kind of things that kind of give you the sense of, oh, these women still talk.
Yeah.
Even though you see them on the same shows, but they still have, you know, conversations and connections, and you don't really get that. You don't really get that with any of. Not even, like, Barry and Oliver are supposed to be, like, really good friends, and they never talk to each other, so.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, even with Oliver being in jail, it was, like, or being outed as Arrow, they're like, we'll talk about that later, and then they never talked about it.
Yeah, and even with the wedding, it seems like Oliver just picked up on the fact that Iris are even getting married. It's like, oh, right, because we forgot to RSVP, because we're not friends.
That was just not believable that none of them RSVP. Day before the wedding.
Right.
moving into our news section, Ruby Rose has officially been cast to play Kate Kane in the new CW series. There's been a lot of, somewhat of a backlash, I guess, for people who aren't really impressed with her casting in terms of her acting. I feel like that's been the largest criticism so far. What do you think about her playing Kate Kane?
Yeah, that's like my, like, when they brought it up, I was like, that's just like the most famous lesbian that Hollywood knows at the moment right now. Like, she hasn't really been in, like, the biggest thing she did is in Orange is the New Black, and then she's also in John Wick 2, but, like, I'm just not impressed with her acting particularly, and I also feel like it's just lazy casting by the WB or CW or whoever. So I'm not, you know, I'm not impressed. I wasn't impressed when this was a rumor, so I'm not impressed now.
Yeah, I feel like, I mean, aside from her acting, which for me was serviceable in Orange is the New Black, I don't have an issue with her acting. I don't know what she can do. But she's not Jewish. And I know people wanted, you know, there were some people that wanted, like, to have, you know, to cast a Jewish lesbian, which I feel like you could find. It's not like you can't find one. So if you're actively looking for someone who is a lesbian, it would be nice to also actively look for someone who is Jewish to make up for characters like Ray and Felicity, who are supposed to be Jewish, but are very, very much not Jewish in any way, shape, or form. So, but anyway, aside from that, I don't have, like, as personal feelings about it as many people did, but I know many people did because she deactivated her Twitter over it, so.
Yeah, that was interesting. I guess more people were upset about it.
I think she made it a little bit worse, though, because she was like, you know, I wish that women and minorities would stop tearing each other down and, you know, stuff like that. And I don't know, the way that it was worded, at first, like, when I read it, I couldn't tell if she was blaming minorities for tearing down women or if it was, like, what, I don't know what she was trying to say or what she was trying to do, but it just kind of didn't hit the right notes.
Right.
I guess, and that made it, I don't know if she got more comments after that or whatever, but
I'm sure she did.
Probably her shutting down or deactivating her Twitter account. Mm-hmm. I'm just looking forward to the numerous, you know, CNN and Time and EW articles about Ruby Rose gets bullied off of Twitter.
Yeah, she deactivated her Twitter, but I mean, in general, I can't say like I'm too thrilled, like it's not exciting for me that she was cast as Kate Kane. I feel like they did want maybe someone who was quote-unquote edgy for the role, which I feel like she fits that type of thing.
I'm not confident that she can carry a show as the lead, but I guess we'll see.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I would hold, like, full judgment until I see her in the role, but as of right now, I don't know. Yeah, I don't know if she can carry the emotional weight of, in terms of acting. I know that she could probably pull off the action stuff, but TBD in terms of all the other stuff.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Basically.
In other news, Supergirl is getting a movie in the DCEU written by the guy who wrote 22 Jump Street. So what are our thoughts on that, given the fact that she's currently on TV?
The writer, the person that wrote 22 Jump Street is going to write a Supergirl script. And so that's, I'm trying to see what the correlation is.
Right. It doesn't add up.
Yeah. And who they're going to choose to be, like, DCEU Supergirl. Mm-hmm. And if we're going to have, like, the same Melissa versus this new girl, DC Wars, who's better?
You know there will be. You know there will be. Even when we haven't seen this girl yet, there will be a war about it.
Yeah.
I think in general it's a good thing that WB is, or DC or whoever's in charge of that, is loosening up this whole, like, oh, if one's on one, it can't be on the other, you know? Like, that already went out the window when they decided to make a Flash movie. So, why not open it up for the others? Like, there can be more than one. There's no reason for there not to be. So, that's fine.
Exactly.
But I have the same, you know, hesitations as Jessica, because it's like, who's writing this, and why, and who's gonna play her, and, like, how much trauma is she gonna have?
They just continue to give opportunities to guys who, I mean, they write decent movies. Like, I laughed during 22 Jump Street, but it wasn't, like, the best thing I've ever seen. And I'm sure that there are other talented people to write for women, because I feel like there's just a nuance in a woman writing it for another woman, and they need to utilize that more. So we'll see. In other news, Kiana Madeira is cast as Spencer Young, who is a gender-bent version of Spin, who is a social media influencer that takes advantage of the quote-unquote new hero in town so she can gain some more fame. This is very exciting.
This is for The Flash, right?
Yes, this is for The Flash.
Yes.
And it's very exciting. She's going to be recurring, and she's another woman of color, and hopefully this will tie into Iris, because she's also supposed to be a reporter type, right?
Mm-hmm. A social media influencer.
The spoilers that were on Reddit, like, some of them were obviously wrong, like, you know, Nora's name is XS and not Rewind or whatever, but this one, and this girl's not Sue, mm-hmm. so it's not just Ralph in any way, but there was, like, a spoiler kind of thing that was talking about Iris befriending, like,
a blogger
woman mm-hmm. who would join, yeah, like, a blogger, video, like, a blogger, right?
Yeah, blogger with a V, yeah.
Yeah, to, you know, be a part of Iris' storyline, and this potential casting, since she is a social media influencer, and I'm wondering if the new hero in town is Nora.
Mm-hmm. That's what I'm thinking, too.
Tied to, like, the three of them.
I hope so. Please.
I'm kind of wondering if she'll be a protege or a rival, because that'll be interesting.
Start as a rival and become a protege.
Ooh.
Yes. I just really hope that it's a real storyline for Iris and isn't, like, because if it's not connected to Iris, it'll be such a waste. So.
Yeah. Like, if Spencer and Nora are, like, you know, friends and get into, like, bad situations because they're both, like, rebels and, you know.
Yeah.
All this kind of shit.
That's true.
There's like, a tie there for Nora as well.
Mm-hmm.
So.
That's true. The character version, like, the character version, that makes no sense. The comic book version of the character is, first off, a man, and is a villain in the sense that they're, like, they create, like, they use, like, a metahuman scare or whatever to create, yeah,
exactly,
fear-mongering the public.
Yeah.
So, doing something like that, even if she starts off doing that, like, unintentionally, just because, like, that's what gets her more hits, that would be a good lesson in how to journal responsibly, right? Responsible journalism.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So, hopefully it's something that we do. Or that they do.
Yeah, also be connected to Cicada, because Cicada would be the mm-hmm. type to kind of use that fear-mongering or
exactly.
whatever to get people to
against metahumans.
Yeah, it certainly ties into, like, Iris's ideal reporting, which is bringing hope and the truth to the city versus, like, the other side, which would be really cool to delve into.
It's what we deserve.
One almost final bit of news. We have Birds of Prey, so it seems like WB is looking to cast a biracial Black Canary for the Birds of Prey film, which is very exciting because I did not expect them to even be looking. I just assumed they're going to cast a white woman. So, that's exciting.
Yeah, Margot Robbie, and because she did say that she wanted more diversity, and as far as we know, Cassandra Cain is going to be in there, so that's diversity there. And then, you know, to have, like, a biracial Black Canary would be, like, great. I don't know if what they're going to do for The Huntress, or, you know, can't have too many women of color in one movie, I guess. But I think it's nice. We don't know if this is just, like, a rumor or if they're actually, like, looking. I don't know if there's a casting call that's been released or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I always appreciate more women of color and diversity in my movies.
Sure.
And if that's something that Margot is really pushing for, then I'm happy that she is connected to it. So.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it could definitely be the case because it was an exclusive by Heroic Hollywood, who's run by Humberto Gonzalez, who also writes for The Wrap, so he has, like, connections and stuff. So I'm sure that that's is what they're probably looking for, and I hope they stay true to that rather
yeah.
than just put it out there and then change their minds.
I agree with this. I mean, I'm excited. I'm more hopeful about Birds of Prey now, for sure, than I was even a couple of weeks ago. So
mm-hmm.
I think...
Same.
Maybe
yeah.
maybe Margot Robbie really, really is an ally. If
I hope
she's
so.
The reason why these changes are being made, you know?
Yeah.
So.
All right. In our final, final bit of news, Jovian Wade has been cast as Cyborg in the Titan spinoff Doom Patrol. Yes! Booyah!
Yes.
which is interesting, because I know that they're a Titans character.
Yeah, they're about Titan. It really does feel like they want Titans to burn. Like, I don't understand.
Titans are a redhead stepchild that they don't care about, because Doom Patrol is their new favorite.
They just used it for the name.
I mean, Doom Patrol is already my new favorite. So I'm already like, well, goodbye, Titans. We'll see you next time. But yes. Because Cyborg and, I already said, Diane Guerrero. Yeah, that's it. That's it. I'm sold. So, we'll see.
Shaping up to be a good cast.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah.
All right. End of news. Moving on into some... social media drama.
Is that controversy?
Yes. Fandom and social media.
Fandom and social media collide this week. An account on Instagram posted a leaked photo of Grant Gustin in his new season 5 Flash suit. That was a test photo. And that photo wasn't supposed to be leaked, obviously. Grant found out about it. Got kind of dramatic that he was going to quit Instagram. And then apparently people insulted and body shamed him for not being quote-unquote man enough to wear the suit. And then he posted a video that he quickly deleted and then ranted in a little post that he wrote that he was very passionate about how he was bullied and shamed for being super skinny and not living up to what people think the Flash should look like on screen. Then, maybe like an hour or two later... Time picked up this news, TV Line, People, E! News, every single major outlet to discuss body shaming and how Grant Gustin went after the haters, but these people did not try to defend Candace Patton or Anna Diop or any of the other black actresses or women of color who have also been gotten hate from day one. They did not respect or care for because they are not white men. So, what are your thoughts on all of this drama?
I feel like this is a very biased introduction to this topic.
I have many feelings about
this. Listen, I was so mad. Like, when I saw, like, the initial video that Grant, like, I didn't even know about the suit. I just saw that he was upset and was like, I'm about to quit Instagram and all this kind of stuff. And I was wondering what happened. And I saw the photo and I didn't really... understand where all the body, because you can't even see his body, first of all, but I guess, like, a lot of people were being mean. It's like, well, that's not cool, because, he's been very open about how he can't really gain weight that much, and how he has, like, issues or insecurities about his body, so I understand that, why he was, like, upset or felt the need to post. What I don't understand, and what makes me actually upset about the whole situation, and not upset about Grant, but, like, the situation in general, is the media around the whole body shaming incident, because just it's a little bit ridiculous. Like, he puts it out there and everyone's like rushing to his aid and like coddling him and like, you know, Grant shut haters. CNN, people, CNN, major news network, Time Magazine, like, are all rushing to his aid when not too long ago, Anna Diop, and I feel like for her specifically, because it was so similar to what Grant just went through,
yeah.
She did not receive the same amount of respect or attention at all.
Not even from her own network and her own, like, her own studio people.
She did get a couple of, like, high-profile people eventually come to her aid and talk about how stupid it was that people were upset that she wasn't an orange alien, in real life. But the fact that she had to come out and say, you know, this is not Starfire's permanent look.
Right.
And yet, DC still hasn't released any concept art of what her look is supposed to be like.
Right.
They still use the same version of that. They still use the same images of the outfit that people were so upset about in all of their promotional imagery. So what is there? And they didn't even say anything about it.
Exactly.
Like, DC has, like, a network, DC Universe. No one came out and said anything in support of her. She didn't get CNN. She didn't get Time. She didn't get E! News or TV Line or any of these other people speaking up on her behalf. And she had to shut down her Instagram account. She actually did. She deleted her entire Instagram, started over, and then had to delete comments again because people were still, like, saying all this racist stuff about her. and she didn't get a tenth, a 16th of what Grant got within 12 hours. And then within, like, 24 to 48 hours, CW had already released the promotion suit so people would be quiet and stop bullying, quote-unquote, Grant. And then he's like, oh, well, now I have permission to show you what a sex supposed to look like. And I didn't get any of that. So
right.
It's just, like, really frustrating, yeah. That part of it.
He, like when... That's the thing. Like, he talked about double standards in his post because he was referring to how it's, like, less... It's not seen as wrong or politically incorrect, which, barf, I hate that phrase. But it's not seen as politically incorrect to make fun of men's bodies. That's what he was referring to. But the real double standard is that a man, like Grant, can say one thing and people will fall silent. Like, people have been arguing with me back and forth on this, but Grant has that power. He has the power to make people shut up. Even if they shut up for a week, it's still a week where people shut up, you know? And he has the power to have CW put out the official promo that they were clearly not planning on doing, you know, before the quote-unquote leak happened. And to post his little set pic or whatever, you know? And Anna didn't get that, like we just said. In fact, her studio is going out of their way, it seems, to continue to perpetuate the hate against her because they will not release the actual look. Anyway, so that's one double standard. And then there's just the fact that women's bodies are policed constantly. Like, yeah, sure, it's not quote-unquote politically correct to talk about women's bodies, but you do it every single day, like, your whole life, right? Like, everyone from your parents to, like, your boyfriend to, like, makeup ads to, like, the TV that tells you what you should look like to the actual government literally policing your body because, you know, laws on abortions, laws about birth control, whatever. You know, all these things. Like, our bodies are policed constantly. So I'm sorry if sometimes people say you're too skinny. but... It's not, like, that's not what the double standard is. The double standard is not that men have to suffer the slings and arrows of mean words while women only have to deal with being men's property.
Yeah, and I think my issue about it was that it's not that he doesn't have a right to defend himself. He absolutely does.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that it's just a little bit dramatic for me because the videos is like, I'm going to threaten to leave Instagram. It's like, dude, if you have a problem, if you can't deal with this shit that other people have dealt with every single day that is far, far worse than what you get, then maybe you do need to shut down your Instagram. Maybe that's for the best, you know?
Stop going hunting for comments.
Yeah, and I mean, defend yourself all you want. Post it. But you're right. The double standard is the fact that women are shamed all the time, every day, for every little thing, whether it's like... Even your hair, if it's not done right, something's wrong with it, you know?
Right.
And then to have, it's just even more disappointing because the media is bullshit. It's just so whitewashed, and it just says to me that they can go off about how someone, a white man, can go after the haters for body shaming, and that's great. People shouldn't body shame anybody, but where is this energy about racism?
Yeah, right. Keep the same energy.
Yeah, that's
but
all we
why
want.
Why can't you talk about it? It just says that everyone... to, like, ignore it and act like it's not really happening to these women who are constantly bullied. And just, like, what, a week ago, someone was in Candace's mentions, for example, saying that they had bought her people, like, 100 years ago or some bullshit.
Right, that if it had been 100 years ago, they would have bought her, yeah.
Yeah, and, like, no one batted an eyelash about that. No one came to her defense. No one has been coming to her defense. Only Minka Kelly from so far of her castmates have come to her defense.
Of Anna,
like,
yeah.
Like, when you have...
To Anna's defense?
Yeah, to Anna's defense. And...
jump back and forth between Candace and Anna, so...
Yeah, sorry. Yeah.
Minka you are
Kelly
not forgiven.
And it's just frustrating because people like Grant do have the power. And I'm not saying that he should constantly do it, but it's not like he hasn't seen it. And it's just... disappointing to see people like even TV Line, who it's like one of the news outlets I have a lot of respect for, put up that news story and don't have that same consideration for Anna, for example, when she was receiving the same thing just a few weeks ago. It's just really, really frustrating. Like, I was so annoyed for hours after that. And Time and CNN, like, don't you have anything better to do? Or
right.
If you are gonna post this, do it for everybody else.
On Newsday at Time and CNN?
I guess so. I mean, again, like, all of these things are terrible, but the hatred and vitriol that some others face that don't get the same attention is just super obnoxious and very, very noticeable. That's all.
Yeah. Agreed.
This rant is brought to you by...
Yeah.
Coming to our TED Talk.
Yeah, basically. So yeah, and it's not like, this isn't like We Hate Grant, and also, by the way, like, because I've gotten a lot of anons over the last couple days about this, and there is a large, like, space, a large gray area between, like, Grant does not actively defend Candace in public from racism, to, like, Grant is a terrible co-star and friend and hates Candace, and she should block him. Okay? Like, it's not, I'm not saying the second one. It's just that it's unfortunate that he does not use his platform for larger matters when he could. He only does it when he's frustrated enough for himself that he feels the need to speak up for himself. And that's okay. Yeah. It's just, I wish that it wasn't that way.
Exactly. All right. Our format this week is a request from an anon on Tumblr who wanted us to talk about Jessica's famous compensation theory and how writers and fandom bias towards characters of color don't seem to get the same consideration or empathy as white characters do in many instances. So I'm sending it off to Jessica, who will be our lovely host this podcast, and break down exactly what we will talk about. Take it away.
Okay. In the DC Comics fandom, racist and misogynistic treatment of characters of color is considered especially rampant. In the DC TV fandom, the smart and dedicated ladies who vow to investigate cases of person of color mistreatment by either writers or fandom are members of an elite squad known as Ladies of Gumption. These are their stories. So our first case is going to be with Supergirl. We know Supergirl has a little bit of an issue in general with women of color specifically, but it also has some issues with their men of color. And so it would be really hard to critique a show on its mistreatment of characters of color when they barely have any. But, you know, of course, that in itself is a problem. But probably like the two biggest examples of how you can see such a stark contrast between how characters of color are treated versus the white characters in the same situation would be, of course, the James Wynn Mon-El situation, and then you have on the lady side Sam, who is played by a woman of color, but she's played as like passing on the show, versus the treatment that Magan and Julia and Grace, who played Purity and Pestilence, got. James is probably the worst treatment, like as far as suffering the most, just because he's the series regular and starting out as the male romantic lead, and so, you know, season one, which I skipped, but they really tried at the beginning to kind of put him in that kind of narrative of the male romantic lead and setting up that story. But in season two in particular, between James Mon-El is an example of, I would say, reverse compensation. So, like, compensation is when, like, the white character or the fan of the white character doesn't really the storybook ending that they think they deserve, and so the writers overcompensate in other areas to, you know, we still care about you, you know, kind of thing. But in this sense, in season two, because they took away James's male romantic lead, they're like, you know, I'm sorry, James fans, we're going to switch from this. But look, he still gets, you know, the Catco Media head position. And look, he still gets to be Vigilante and Guardian. Isn't that still cool? And he's got a new and improved Wynn as a sidekick, because season one, Wynn didn't really like James, but season two, we're going to make them friends, and now James has all this stuff to do, so it's not like he's totally diminished, which he actually is, because he's, you know, not the top person in Kara's life anymore, but don't worry about that, because he's still got stuff to do. That kind of thing is what happened to James in season two. And the only problem with that, even, you know, even with removing him from that romantic lead position and trying to compensate by giving him other stuff, they didn't really genuinely care enough about James to do anything with either of those storylines. So like we said, Kara was hardly ever at Catco, which meant there's no scenes for James at Catco, and when she was at Catco, she was interacting with Snapper Carr, so they gave her a new role, they added another role into James' space, in which she didn't interact with. So even with Kara at Catco and tied to Catco, there still wasn't room for James and Kara at Catco. And And then there are so many holes in the Guardian storyline, and the main one being that Kara disapproved and even looked down on James for wanting to help, and flat out telling him that she favored Mon-El, someone who had proven himself to be completely untrustworthy and unreliable and arrogant, over a friend that she already had a deep connection and trust with. So you have, you know, James, who somehow, because the writer said he did, had like a, you know, martial arts background, combat background, wanted to help, knows Superman, is best friends with Clark, knows Kara, trusts Kara, Kara trusts him, and yet she is insisting on building Mon-El into a better man while shoving aside James, who is already a better man. And it's a direct parallel, I think, to how the writers chose to focus on the feelings and development of this white male character, Mon-El, versus black male character. You know, instead of giving James that time and attention to either his Guardian storyline or the Catco storyline, they were intent on pushing Mon-El into the forefront and forcing the audience to care about Mon-El, which is what Kara was doing, you know, pushing for and fighting for Mon-El over James. And despite the fact that James was the leading man that the writers wanted on paper, like on paper, he's great. On paper, it's season one, James was everything that, you know, fandom should have wanted in a leading, you know, romantic lead for a male. But they couldn't really connect his point of view or his story in the script, like in the narrative, in the actual show. There's a disconnect there. And his story only really improved when the writers committed to putting him with Lena in season three. And we now see this because the writers also shifted from Kara being the inspiration behind the story to Lena being the inspiration behind the story. So James and Lena works because Lena is not like the lead de jure. It's still Kara is supposed to be the lead, but Lena feels like the lead de facto. And, you know, you can blame it on chemistry or whatever, because fandom loves to do that whenever they don't like a ship. But the writers couldn't connect James to Kara, the actual lead, but they can connect him to Lena, who is not the lead, but kind of the one that they have the most, like, feeling for. So that, I kind of feel like that's why they are able to kind of connect it in their mind that they can only care about James in this role, because it's not, you know, the lead role that he's involved with, but they still care about Lena, so that's why it kind of works. And then when you get over into the women of color side, and especially like the villain category, you can compare the stark contrast in the treatment of Sam, who is white passing, and as far as we know, she's white on the show, even though she's not. She's played by Odette Annabelle, who is a woman of color, and then even Lena, to some extent, even though she's not villain full time, the way that the writers treat her is, you know, above and beyond what they treated Magan, who started out as an assumed villain, and the other two were killers, Purity and Pestilence. So the main difference is how much time and attention is given to Sam and Lena's stories. So much care is taken into wanting the audience to understand these women, to care about them, to mourn for their tragic eventual descent into darkness, and to want to save them. Both Sam and Lena got, like, Sam had a whole entire season's worth of development to that point of, we need to save her. And Lena, since she got there, has been kind of going back and forth over that line, but her relationship to Kara makes people want to not see her go down that route, even though you know it's eventually where she's headed. And you compare that to Magan, who punishes herself by fighting in, like, alien death matches because of the guilt that she feels, despite being innocent of the crimes that her white Martian people are responsible for. And she's rescued several green Martians, but her, even though her heroism is explained to us and to John, who is understandably unnerved when he discovers her secret, he still chooses to punish and imprison her for crimes she didn't even commit. And then we don't even see her again, or see John struggle with separating his experience with white Martians with Magan until the plot deems that it's convenient for John to let her out and somehow, in that span of an instant, fall in love with her too. Which, you know, that's just plot for convenience, I think. But, you know, at least for Magan, she got a serious regular character connected to her story, care about her, and tied to the story, and possibly tied the audience into it as well, even if just for a little bit. But Julia and Grace don't even get, like, a tenth of that. There's really any time spent on them for the audience to get attached to them. When you do see them, they're either, you know, attacked immediately and not believed, or, you know, they don't even get I think they're only in there for like one or two episodes really, so you don't really even have time to get attached to them. Certainly there's no one to mourn them after they're gone, not in narrative, not in the audience. And like Rain doesn't certainly seem to care that she just lost two sisters, and Kara and the team and the DEO are under the false impression that saving one out of three ain't bad. So it's kind of really a struggle to figure out, like, and, you know, and then you know, if they're gonna bring in more diversity the next season, it's kind of like it's hard to get a little bit excited about it, because, you know, if there's not that detail that goes into supporting these characters and giving them the depth of story that they would have given like a white character, then, you know, I'm just not into seeing like potential people that I like get the shaft for the limited time that they're on a show. So.
You're right. Like, we are getting more. I know we already know that we're gonna have like General Haley, I think that's her name, and she's gonna be a black woman, and there's gonna be more women of color coming in next season. But it's not like we haven't seen that before. Like when Magan came on, Sharon Leal was introduced as being a recurring character, and it was something to get excited about. We were very excited for Magan, and of course, Maggie was introduced as being a woman of color and being a Latina, and both of those, you know, Magan was treated the way she was treated was atrocious, and it was like she was there to try to create a storyline for John, because John, as the other black man on the show, the not James black man, had never had up to that point like anything outside of being head of DEO and a pseudo dad to Kara and Alex. Like, that's what he does, right? So they tried to give him a storyline, but like you said, they didn't go in depth with it. And to top it off, McGon was derided, she was locked up, she was dismissed, and she just disappeared until an episode in season 3 where she could just devote herself to someone else's cause, right? Like, that was, like, her character. Her character is, like, consumed by guilt over something that isn't her fault, and then devoting her life, you know, being punished for it.
Being punished by John.
Yes, and then devoting her life to righting someone else's wrong as well, you know? So, like, that's been her story. And now we know that General Haley, if that's her name, she's gonna be like a rule follower and like someone who also is devoted to her cause. So I'm like, okay. Plus, you know, the way that Purity, like Julia, right? Again, when she was introduced, she was attacked, she was talked down to, intimidated, and then she had to sacrifice herself for someone else's cause. So it's not a good look so far. We have not changed that. We'll hope that it's gonna be different in season four. And if it is different, it'll be different because we have different writers. And I don't know how many different writers Supergirl has, but we can hope that there are several. And then of course on the flip side, or I don't know if it's the flip side, but on the other hand, we have Roulette and Pestilence, who are two Asian villains, and they are both women who are literally, like, creating injustice and profiting from it, and then are punished and dismissed by the narrative for having done so. So, like, in general, we have a lot of women of color that are introduced to profit from injustice. Like, when you have storylines about, you know, that are stand-ins for discrimination, right? It's always uncomfortable and strange when the characters of color are the ones that are causing that discrimination, because it's like that whole, like, oh, what if we were the ones being oppressed instead, you know?
Right.
And, like, on the one hand, you might think that psychologically that'll help people understand it, but instead, it doesn't. It just makes them be like, yeah, I don't like that character of color.
Validates that, exactly. You know, oh, yeah, I am special, I am right, and these characters of color are doing the wrong thing, and...
Mm-hmm. Exactly. You know, so...
It never goes to, like, the correlation that, oh, this is a real thing, and it's happening because... you know, white people are doing the oppressing. That's not where it goes.
Exactly. So, I mean, in terms of John, they definitely improved when they brought on Mirren. Like, for, I don't know what it was that with Mirren and John, they really did manage to craft a, like, impactful and meaningful storyline for John that, like, lasted several episodes. So I don't know if that was because that was after AJK got the boot, or if that was because it was another black man that they're already comfortable with writing, you know, that at this point they've already gotten James right. They've already, you know, started to get the hang of John, because they haven't been able to do that for black women yet. So we'll find out. Stay tuned for season 4. But on the other hand, we have Maggie Sawyer, who was meant to be a Latina, right? It's like the opposite of Odette. Although to be fair, Odette Annabelle, like, she's, like, to whatever degree she is a white Latina, right? She is white passing, and she was played as a white character. Whereas Maggie is played by definitely a white woman, Floriana Lima, right? She's a white woman, but the character is of color. And I feel like because the actress is white, it's, like, subconsciously easier for them to write for her. Because, like, Maggie has, like, had so much staying power, not just in the fandom, but in the narrative. Like, all of Alex's storyline has been Maggie, you know? Mm-hmm. All season has gone back to that breakup with Maggie and, like, moving forward from that and, like, what her life is going to be without her, etc., you know? So that's unusual for a show like Supergirl, I would say. But anyway, the fact that...
It's kind of odd and a little bit weird that the only reason it seems like the writers were able to care about Maggie so much is because they know that she's not actually a person of color.
Right.
She's played by a white woman, and they connect to her that way. So it's kind of like, it is a little bit, you know, talk about whitewashing before, but it's kind of like a little bit of a slap. And you can throw in Saturn Girl in there as well.
Yep.
Because later on, they very much coded her as being Indian, and she's also played by a white woman who makes a career out of playing an Indian woman, but it's almost like, you know, we're adding this diversity in these characters of color, but they're actually white women, so we will actually care, like, their stories only matter because they are played by white women and not that they are characters of color.
Right.
Is what it feels like.
Yes. I agree with this. Because, like, Sam, even though Sam got a lot, you know, she got a lot of screen time, and obviously she was the main, quote-unquote, villain for the story, and she got, you know, a happy ending, but it was, her struggles in the story were, like, always in service to, like, Lena's, like, I have to experiment on my friend, I have pain about this, and then, like, Alex being like, oh, Ruby is like a surrogate child to me, and I need a child, and blah, 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 whatever, you know? Like, Sam wasn't even present for half her storyline because she was taken over by Rain. So, that's pretty much, those are all my thoughts on on the treatment of characters of color on Supergirl. For some reason, they can treat characters of color better when they are played by white people.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, adding on to what you've already said, I feel like they treated Livewire even a bit better than Pestilence and Purity in season 3, because she at least got to have a redemptive storyline and prove to Kara that she can and has changed. And then they allowed Kara to bond with her in a way they never let her bond with Pestilence, Purity, and even Sam, something which was strange given that they were from the same planet and they never really interacted. In terms of Mon-El, they allowed him to express himself, a hero's journey, and it was somewhat successful because he had fans and fans who defended his behavior and also believed he could get better, and that the narrative and fans thought him more deserving of Kara's time, energy, and love more than they did James. So, like, James, who was always there for her and who was always willing to be supportive and a shoulder to lean on, got sidelined to give the spotlight over to Mon-El, who's like the walking example of white male privilege and is proof that he can get second, third chances so long as he's willing to say that he can change, you know? And they absolutely did Pestilence dirty and didn't allow for any sympathy toward Impurity or their situations. Like, they were used for the plot, which made no sense anyway, and then they were discarded without a second thought. Sam had it a bit better, but she still didn't fare well nearer to the end. Like, I think you were going to mention that she was, as a means to further along Lena and Alex's storylines, didn't really have one of her own. And then on screen, she was never confirmed to be a woman of color, nor did they play her that way, unlike Maggie, who was, like, the complete opposite.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's why it's referred to the show of white feminism.
Yep. So yeah, we're definitely rooting for you in season 4 to change that around.
The verdict on Supergirl is guilty.
Guilty!
Only caring about characters of color when they're played by white people.
Yes.
Next case on the docket is Arrow. Mm-hmm. Arrow has had quite a few of color pass through their show on their 6 seasons, and somehow most of those appearances have been pretty, like, problematic, but what are your guys' takes on Arrow and its treatment of the characters of color on the show?
Well, the thing with Arrow is that it completely lacks the ability to sustain narratives for characters of color. Like, how, when the show started, Diggle actually made a comment about how he's not just Oliver's driver / bodyguard, right? Or the comment was ironic because he said that that's what he was. And you're like, LOL, he's pointing it out. I can't wait for him to get his own storyline and develop a personality and blah, 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 blah. That did not happen. That's a, well, it's like kind of happened now, but it took a very long time, and it, has it really happened? Can we really say that it's happened?
It happened for the plot and for Oliver.
Yes, exactly. So, he, like, I don't know if y'all remember this, but he dated Carly Diggle, his brother's ex, for a while in season one, right? And she had her son, so that was his nephew, right? This whole ass family that he was building. And then they just disappeared without a trace, right? Like, it was weird. Like, it was a weird relationship. Like, it's weird to date your brother's ex. And then, you know, become your nephew's father. But it was even weirder that they just disappeared. Like, does he miss them? Does he care about them? Like, he mentioned her one time when his brother...
Does he see her?
Right, we don't know, right? Like, that's your fucking nephew right there, you know? Like, but whatever. And then his brother came back to life, and he mentioned her one time, and that was it. Speaking of which, Diggle, you know, his brother came back and was, like, kind of evil, and, like, didn't Diggle have to kill him? Like, isn't that what happened?
Yeah.
Yeah. So Diggle had to kill his own damn brother. And is that affecting him still? Like, could that be part of why he wants to become Green Arrow to atone for his sins? Or is that why he started doing drugs as well as because of the pain? No, we don't know. There's not, this doesn't matter, right? It's nothing. It's not relevant to his story anymore, even though you think that killing your own brother would be very relevant to you for a very long time. But it is not, because that is not relevant to Oliver, and therefore it is not relevant to Diggle. Whew! Then his big...
But wait, there's more.
Yes, there's more. His big storyline last year was this impromptu decision that he wants to be Oliver, basically. He wants to be the Green Arrow. And there's absolutely no explanation for why this would be the case, right? Like, he has never before expressed an interest in shooting arrows, let alone in being the Green Arrow, right? We already had different colored arrows, so I don't know why he couldn't be one of the other colors. It still doesn't make sense. And this is after, of course, the several episodes worth of being addicted to steroids or painkillers or whatever fucking drug he was taking. This just, it's literally just, like May said, for the plot. It's not based in who Diggle is as a person at all. Because I don't know that the showrunners really, or the old showrunner, of course, really has a grasp on who Diggle is as a character. Which is an issue.
It's the original character.
Yes. Yes.
It's your character.
And now, you know, that's not even getting into the whitewashing that Arrow routinely engages in, such as Sin and Sandra, who were both, well, Sin was Asian, and Sandra was Asian and Black, and they both became white, even though Sandra's name got changed to Samantha or whatever later. But Sandra being white meant that William was white, when in the comics, Oliver's only child is Connor Hawke, whose mother was Black and Asian, like I said, and that was a part of his storyline, and now it is not. So William gets lots and lots of space to whine about Oliver being a bad father, about Oliver being, you know, Green Arrow, whatever, right? And Oliver spends a lot of time caring more about William than he does Felicity, which is great, but would it be that way if his child was Black and Asian and not white? No, it would not. No, it would not. So, and then, yes.
They would probably actually have a very contentious storyline where Oliver, they would probably have, like, the Oliver Renee dynamic. If Connor was Black and Asian.
That's true.
Yep.
Yep. Yep, I can see that. Anyway, so like I mentioned, Carly Diggle disappeared without a trace. Lila Michaels does not disappear without a trace, because she is a nice white woman. So she is stuck by Diggle's side and is, like, his only storyline. Even if that storyline is, like, twice a season, they're like, we have a son. But anyway, so despite, you know, so when you have Lila as a comparison, Amanda Waller was shot in the head so that Lila could take her job. And then do it better than Amanda ever did, obviously, right? Because that's just a story, even though that's been...
Bull.
Right.
That's, like, bullshit.
Yeah, that's been Amanda's job for the entirety of comics, but Lila Michaels can do it better. Okay. And then, of course, we have to remember how Shadow, an Asian woman, was literally killed so that Sarah could live. Like, literally, there was a choice between Shadow and Sarah. And Oliver was like, well, obviously I will take the white woman. And even though he and Slade were in love with her all season, supposedly, in the flashbacks, no one could save her. She just had to die. And her only value was fuel for Slade's man pain and another guilty chip on Oliver's shoulder. As opposed to Sarah being killed and brought back 300 times. And even Laurel, the queen of disrespectful treatment, has also been brought back as a doppelganger and allowed to continue her previous legacy. I think Shadow had, like, a sister or something. Like, was there, like, something like that? She appeared for, like, half a second.
She had a twin sister.
Yes.
Yeah.
So it was like, hi, I exist. Goodbye. Anyway, so that was that. I guess that was their way of being like, live on off screen. So then finally, the most obvious discrepancy, which is actually more so in fandom treatment, like, because this is all writing. The writing has utterly failed. Like, I think we can say it utterly has failed with characters of color. It is horrible. Horrible. But when it tried a little bit with NTA, and that is Curtis, Dinah, and Renee. And that is entirely composed of characters of color. But the fandom has received them so poorly that even when the writers try to be fair to them, right, even though, like, there is a degree to which you could argue that they don't take racial bias into account because they have so much of themselves that they wouldn't know how to compensate for it, I'm sure. So no one in the fandom can understand why Dinah, Renee, and Curtis would be beset at Oliver for invading their privacy, for treating them like hostile entities when they're supposed to be a family, and for, like, refusing to believe in them or take their word for things, right? Like, they don't understand why these three people want to be treated as equals, because they don't see them as equals. But basically, like, when there's two opposing viewpoints on the show and no one's a villain, you would think that the split in the audience is supposed to be something close to 50-50. And you see this all the time in ship wars, right? Even when the ship isn't, one ship isn't even canon, when you have two options, people will split up accordingly. But instead, like, even reviewers and journalists and, like, everyone, it was literally, like, us and then everyone else who hates NTA. Like, everyone else is OTA. And there's no reasonable explanation for it, aside from the fact that one of them is, you know, composed entirely of characters of color, and then the other half is Oliver and Felicity and Diggle, who usually goes along with them, until the end when he didn't, and then everyone was like, well, goodbye Diggle as well. This is terrible writing. We hate that Diggle has made his own choice and left. So.
And, it, like, you could tell some of, like, the fandom tweets and stuff about NTA and how they refer to NTA and how, like, you know, you should be grateful, Oliver, for, you know, saving your ass and, you know, that they're not respectful and, like, all of this, like, really coded, you know, you're tiptoeing all over that line.
Yes.
What you really want to say, especially with, I think Renee got it the worst, mm-hmm. to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
She definitely got it the worst. Curtis was just treated as ungrateful because he stopped caring about Felicity.
Mm-hmm.
And then Dinah took up too much of the story that was not going to Felicity.
Yep.
Was that your final?
That's it. That's my final answer.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, Arrow is more tricky because, like you said, they have always lacked people of color, but the first thing that comes to mind is honestly last year's crossover because it was an Arrow episode. So before the hijacking of the wedding, Iris spent most of the Arrow portion of the crossover comforting Felicity and making sure she was taken care of, like with regards to the situation in terms of her feelings over the relationship issues she was having with Oliver, a white couple. Not once did Felicity apologize that Iris' wedding was the one that was interrupted. Never did the narrative itself acknowledge that as a black woman, Iris was also a target of the Nazis. And never did Felicity or anyone else comfort Iris about what she was going through. So in terms of fandom, people were rightfully angry that Barry and Iris' wedding was hijacked by Oliver and Felicity, but the Felicity fans acted righteous and weren't at all bothered by what happened. Like, if it had been vice versa and Barry and Iris had hijacked Oliver and Felicity's wedding, you better believe that they would have been pissed off for a full year. And it would have never let it go.
Never.
Yeah. And they thought Felicity deserved to marry Oliver in that particular moment and showed her empathy because they thought she deserved it. Like, Iris was bitter for one hot second in the next episode of The Flash, and she was called out for not showing feminist behavior and supporting Felicity. So, like, there was no sympathy for her during this entire situation, and fandom instead defended their white faves, basically. More recently, many fans and critics have been largely reluctant to embrace NTA. Fans come up with reasons to hate them even when they defend Oliver. Like, when that whole team breakup happened, Renee was blamed solely for the issues. There was no empathy shown for his situation or the safety of his daughter. And interestingly, the narrative showed him a bit more sympathy than actual fans did, but it was still slight. So, like, they forgot that Renee has a daughter and Oliver has a son, but it's like, it's okay because Oliver's son is more important than Renee's daughter. And then in terms of Dinah, she wanted to go after Laurel after she killed Vincent. Oliver showed sympathy for Laurel. And I remember when he talked to Dinah, she said he was letting her off the hook because he still couldn't see her as a bad person. So even though she did kill someone and Dinah was justified in her anger, Oliver was showing more sympathy towards Laurel, the white woman, for her actions, while he treated Dinah like she was kind of crazy for being so aggressive and wanting revenge. So, like, if the situation had been flipped, I don't think he would have felt the same way. And even as a semi-villain, Laurel still got loads more sympathy from Quentin as well, but the same sympathy wasn't given to Dinah from any of the white characters the same way that they were for Laurel. And then, like you said, Diggle, he's always been sidelined for Oliver, or his feelings deemed not as important until the story required them to be. So take last season's storyline, for example. Diggle became Green Arrow because Oliver had to step back for his son, and the narrative pretty much completely neglected the fact that Diggle also had a family too, and has had one for much longer than Oliver has. Like, Oliver was insta-dad, and all of a sudden the narrative revolved around that fact, you know? And Diggle rarely gets to have feelings of his own, and when he does, it's usually for Oliver, and when it's against Oliver, he's called out for it, even though he's always supporting Oliver, but doesn't get as much of the support back.
Yeah, I think the general rule of thumb, characters of color are only treated well when they're cheerleaders for either Oliver or Felicity a lot of the times. And then just in general, like, I never really get attached to women of color introduced on Arrow because I always assume that they're not long for this world. Like Tati mentioned, like, the lackadaisical treatment in Shadow, mm-hmm. Is one. And then as well, like, you have Laurel's and Carly Diggle, but you have Laurel's DA friend who disappeared, never to be seen again after season one. So we don't know what happened to Carly. We know Shadow died, and we don't know what happened to her Laurel's DA friend. Other season one villains, Bronze Tiger and China White, they also disappeared. That probably had something to do with Suicide Squad. I'm not sure, but, you know, still it's kind of like they were flash in the pan kind of villains that Deadshot got more of a story, and he's also a Suicide Squad, but he got more of a story continuing on into later seasons than either Bronze Tiger or China White. Amanda Waller was probably the most upsetting to me, just like specifically for what Tati mentioned, that she was shot in the head so that Lila can have her job, and that's the only reason. Like, she couldn't have been promoted to head over Argus South or North or wherever else, and then Lila just take over for, you know, Argus Star City, you know? Mm-hmm. She had to be shot in the head, violently killed, you know, to get her out of the way. And this past season, Arrow introduced Amanda Watson, and as much as I loved her, like, no-nonsense approach, now she was, like, clearly so much smarter than everybody else in the room, she disappears halfway in the season. Like, she arrests Oliver, she gets her man, and then she leaves town for another half of the season and doesn't really come back into the finale. Like, you know, I would expect her to be there at the trial, just, like, glaring at Oliver and getting ready to, like, see it all the way through, but, you know, she's done her job with what the plot demanded, so she has to disappear until the plot demands to come back again. Mm-hmm. And she's another antagonist, too. So that's another, you have, when they bring in women of color, she usually has an antagonist role. So Samantha's another antagonist, much like Waller was to Oliver. They don't really like Oliver. They don't get along. And because they don't get along, then the writers don't get along with them. Mm-hmm. But even minor black women characters aren't really spared, because there's that one black woman, I think her name was like Tigers or something, and Thea's goodbye episode, she literally stayed alive long enough since, you know, Dorothy on her merry way down the Yellow Brick Road gave Thea a clue, and then she was killed, like, immediately afterwards. So just, like, why keep bringing on black women if you're just gonna kill them off in violent ways? Mm-hmm. Like, Eric in general treats all of his women like shit, so, you know, yay equality, I guess, and get treated like shit too, but it's just, you know, consistently, every time, and we've got two new black women coming on Arrow for next season, or I guess Amanda's coming back, and then you have the, one of the long bow hunters is a black woman, and I feel like there's one more. It's great, but I'm not really getting my hopes up or getting invested in them, and I guess, because Arrow's another one with a huge turnover in the writer's room, there's a lot of new talent there, so... And they have black women in the writer's room this season. So mm-hmm. Hopefully that improves quality of the writing for the black women that they have on the show. And any other women of color, because they have, I think they have an Asian woman as well in their writer's room.
Yes.
So, you know, any other, hopefully with this new writer's room, this writer's room looks very promising. We'll see that change in the way that the characters are written, the characters of color written on the show. But on the men's side, like, you guys already talked about Diggle, and Diggle is only treated very well, I think, mainly because he is a cheerleader for not only Oliver, but for Elysia's ship. And it feels like in Phantom, whenever David Ramsey goes to cons, that 85% maybe of what he talks about is Elysia. And so that's the only way that he's safe is if he's not going against Oliver, or if he's supporting Felicity, or he's supporting Oliver and Felicity together. Outside of that, and that's I think when, you know, when we're talking about Supergirl and the writers not being able to connect to these characters of color unless they're being played by white women, and it's so that writers can't really connect to the characters of color if they're not, or specifically Diggle, if he's not, you know, up Oliver's ass all the time. And the same thing with Curtis, because Curtis is largely used as a prop for Felicity. Initially, when he came on as Felicity's sidekick, pretty much. And he had a husband initially, but they didn't really focus. It kind of ran in the background, and then they got divorced. But you never really saw like the fallout of that until they needed Curtis to be bitter about Felicity and Oliver getting married. And I think a lot of people, when the whole NTA group came up, the feelings towards Curtis was because he was abandoning Felicity and turning to Dinah. So he became Dinah's sidekick, quote unquote, and not Felicity's. And so his kind of stock went down in Phantom. And then you have the whole Renee versus Oliver, very contentious, even from the get-go when Renee first was introduced.
Yeah.
He was introduced, as kind of a quote-unquote thug, street fighter, whatever, and Oliver is kind of like the mean dad. I feel like it's another kind of dynamic that they have between specifically Oliver and Felicity and everybody else. Not so much Diggle. Like, Diggle can be on the same tier because he agrees with them all the time, but especially when it was OTA versus NTA, like, NTA were the disrespectful, disobedient kids to mom and dad, quote unquote. And it was just kind of like a lot of the language and narrative, especially with Oliver being, it was a little bit condescending, specifically with regard to his back and forth with Renee. And it's like the thing that kind of was the most like annoying part of it was the whole, like you saying, with the father daughter and father son dynamics, where Oliver clearly understands why Renee would have to sell him out for his daughter, because Oliver would have done the same thing for his son, and yet that's still like a line that Oliver said that you've crossed, even though I've been spying on you because I don't trust you for weeks now, and I know the reason why that you did this, but I still refuse to understand you, or, you know, work something, or understand why we didn't have an open door policy where you could come and talk to me about it instead of going through with it and, you know, lying about it, things like that. It's kind of feel like all Renee's life, he's had to fight. he's had to fight consistently, especially when compared to Oliver. Within the narrative, which is, I don't know, I feel bad for Renee a lot of times, but I
do too. No, I feel bad for Renee, both in the narrative and in fandom.
Yeah, and even when he tries to do right, like, it's still considered, he gets backlash from fandom.
Yeah.
But I do want to throw this in. Another two women in the Arrow show that I feel like didn't get a lot of respect as far as their storyline, Gia Katana. What was that, in season 4 or so? And she didn't really get a lot of, she was like a...
No, season 3. Just kidding, sorry, season 3.
I think she was season 3 and maybe in season 4.
Yeah, she probably was still in season 4.
Yeah, I think her story may have started in season 3, and then she got like another like guest spot in season 4 or whatever. But that was like a major DC character that wasn't really used to utilize his full advantage. And I do remember like that the season winter finale cliffhanger when Oliver's like stabbed and like falls off the cliff, and it's up to, you know, Katana to like nurse him back to health and all this kind of stuff. I don't even know what she's doing now. Like, I don't know where her story ended. And then I think she just said that she didn't want to be contested again. And then like the writer said that seriously, like, well, we're never going to show this person again. So I don't really feel like she got the respect or the story, or even like the staying power or recurring power that some other villains have gotten, in, or just characters in general that you see come back, have that attachment to the audience, was not given to her. And then also Nyssa being a woman of color, and then the, not only is she's a woman of color, but she's also a lesbian.
Mm-hmm.
You have the whole storyline of, you know, she's trying to prove herself to her father, but she's always devalued by, like, Oliver is a better fighter or better whatever than her. The fact that she was forced to marry him, to be put through that. But, I guess final verdict on Arrow. Arrow is guilty of treating all of its character of colors like shit, unless they are cheerleading the main white couple.
Yep. That is 100% accurate.
But they could get probation next because of the writer's room, so we'll see. We're in wait and see mode in that. We'll see if they can get probation and early release.
Yes.
Next on the docket is The Flash. The Flash has a lot of diversity, a lot of characters of color. But what are your thoughts on writer treatment of minority characters in The Flash?
Okay. Well, like you said, Flash has the most on-screen diversity of the Arrowverse proper, but that's not reflected behind the scenes, which unfortunately means that it's cast of color, and that's mostly a black cast, excluding Carlos Valdez, is often given the shaft, even though they're arguably the heart of the series, especially the West family. So the most obvious example that we have been railing against for years is how Iris was never allowed to voice her struggles until the plot called for it, until some specific moment where suddenly her feelings would be revealed, and that would mean something to Barry, or to Eddie, or to Joe, or whoever. So she was often held hostage by the narrative, even though Candace did an excellent job of portraying the nuance of Iris's emotions with her face, so you could always tell what she was feeling, even though she was not given the dialogue for it. But the audience does not perceive those feelings on her face because they don't care to look at her face and understand what it is saying, since they already, you know, see her as less than certain other characters.
It kind of reminds me of, you know, how there was like a study of some, like a black guy, he did this kind of study with like computers and cameras. So mm-hmm. like whenever he tried, he could never get like the paper towel machine to recognize that he was in front of it and he needed a paper towel because the AI only recognized like white faces and white people. So mm-hmm. I think it was also like he did one in front of like a computer. So when he's in front of a computer and he's trying to like move around, the camera's supposed to follow him, the camera would never follow him. But when he got his white coworker over there, suddenly like, the camera knew exactly where she was. So it's kind of like the same, I feel, with Iris and her emotions. Like, she's doing all the stuff.
Mm-hmm.
The audience pick up on all the stuff because she's not white.
Yeah, exactly. And also, it's also like the empathy, you know, like that people would think literally believed that black people felt less pain than white people.
Yes.
Like, they actually believed that. So, like, that's... It's like that, too. Like, instead, they will make up pain for Caitlin, right? In order to make romantic feelings for Barry and from Barry possible there. She does not possess these feelings, but they make them up for her. Just like they make up the shame and pain that Barry must feel in the face of Iris's, like, teasing. Like, oh my god, I can't believe that Iris would make fun of him for loving science. Like, a friend would never make fun of their friends when everyone knows it's a joke. That could never happen. Barry must be so hurt and betrayed all this time. The pain that he feels, the abuse he's going through. So anyway.
Apparently they can't read his face when she does it because they're not.
Exactly.
He likes it, he's fine.
Yeah. So like at that same time, they can't read the adoration that Iris herself feels for Barry or the pain she feels exactly. When Barry, Joe, and Eddie leave her out and keep shit from her, right? But we moved past that because she finally got to know the truth, and of course, when she expressed those very real emotions of hurt and betrayal, people got angry with her for doing so, because she should just keep quiet. But then we move on to 2A, where this was when the writers actually, you know, like, it went beyond just the, like, holding the feelings hostage, to, like, literally, like, she went 4 episodes without talking about her issue with her mom, you know, like her mom and her, you know, surprise brother. And she would even brush off the like one attempt that Barry made to comfort her. And instead Barry and Joe had to talk about her amongst themselves. So she was keeping a major secret that should have been weighing her down, but all you get was like a silent look off into the distance while Linda is talking, you know? So that was, like, the worst possible treatment for Iris in comparison to how Caitlin got to talk to everyone who would listen about Ronnie, right, at every possible opportunity. And then later when Jay died, like, they made us pretend like we cared that she kissed him one time and that he was dead. And we did not care about either of those things. So once she, you know, got to actually be with Barry in season three, it's like, again, it's like a little bit better because she actually gets her romance, but at the same time, she's not allowed to be angry. Like, she couldn't be angry at Barry for Flashpoint when everyone else got to be angry to some degree with him, right? Especially Caitlin and Cisco got to be angry, got to be angrier than her. And that's, like, compensating, I think, for the audience, that they knew that the audience would get mad at her if she did a single thing about it. Just like she had to also, like, comfort Joe back in season two and accept him and also make up with Joe in one episode in season three. So, and then more comforting on her part had to happen when she thought she was going to die. She was the one that was trying to make other people feel okay about it, consistently devaluing her life in favor of other things, which, of course...
You gotta talk Caitlin into saving her.
Yep. And, of course, that makes her a saint, and it's like, you know, I love her all the more because she's so wonderful and selfless, but it's also just tiring to watch her have to do that. Like, you know that that's that happens to her so that people won't hate her because she is a Black woman. Like, so it's very upsetting. I mean, it's that, like, either they're doing it on purpose so that people won't hate her, or it's because they just don't care because she's a Black woman. So either way, it's terrible, right? It's not good either way. It's either, like, there's different levels of just awfulness. But anyway, the ironic part, I think, is that season four has been such a huge improvement for her. Like, yes, she had to quit her job, but the fact that they actually made that a thing and, like, gave her an episode where she talked about that is an improvement over what they've done with her job in the past. And more importantly, she was allowed to have and voice negative emotions. Like, we started season four with her not wanting to bring Barry out of the Speed Force, not losing, having lost that faith that she's always had, right? Like, which I think was such an important step because it shows that Iris can falter and Iris can be vulnerable and Iris can need support from others, which is not something that they have been as willing to showcase for her before. And of course, the irony there is that giving her more dimensions, giving her more emotions, and giving her more of a voice caused the hatred that's died down for her since season two to rise up stronger and harder, like House Greyjoy, because now she's actively taking away from the whites, right? She's, like, taking leadership away from, I don't know, fucking Harry and Barry and whatever, right? And, like, ordering white people around and when she should be knowing her place. And that is really what has upset people about Iris in season four. Okay, that was a long, long, long talk about Iris, but I've still got other people to talk about. So, the rest of the West, just really quickly. Joe, everyone talks about, like, oh, Iris is treated so badly and, like, Joe's written so much better, but Joe, like, lives for Barry, right? Like, in season one, he literally was there to cater to Barry's needs. So much so that we started the hashtag, do you have a daughter, Joe? Because he did not cater to Iris's needs at all. And then in season two, he put Barry above Wally, too. You know, he's rarely allowed to have his own storyline, including a storyline with children who are not Barry. And again, season four was a big improvement for him because of the addition of Cecile and his own baby, which is ironic because even though Joe's world is expanding, Jesse L. Martin is like, I don't want to be here. So he has not been in it as much, but Joe now has a fuller life, right? And the only, I guess, is ironic because, like, now that he's less about Barry, he shows up less because Barry is what it's about. Unless it's Ralph, and he's definitely not going to be about Ralph.
About Barry now, so, like, Iris, there can only be one. It's the
right,
Highlander.
Exactly. The Highlander thing again. Anyway, so, in a way, Cecile and Jenna are kind of stand-ins for Joe, since Joe isn't going to be around as much, but they're, like, Cecile, sort of as the new Joe, if you will, is getting a lot more development that she would never have gotten in previous seasons because women, as we know, are just there to exist for a man. So since she's there to exist for a man, but that man is not actually there that often, she actually gets to do stuff. Yay, Cecile!
They gave her a new man in Harry Wells.
Exactly! Oh, God. Anyway, then you've got Wally, who never got the training arc that he deserved, right? And while his sudden departure was not the writer's fault, but you see how poorly he was treated when you bring in Ralph and you see how well Ralph is treated. Like, that's literally the story that Wally should have gotten. Yeah. So, and even, like, I don't, no one wants to talk about this, but Wally was a fuckboy in the beginning of his, like, story arc in the Flash comics. Like, at the start, he was just, like, a little shit who was constantly, like, leading girls on to breaking up with them for nonsense reasons and then moving on to the next girl, right? And he had, like, no, like, constantly, like, feeling like he was in Barry's shadow and, like, trying to get out of it and stuff. You know, so he started off being very insecure before he developed into Wally that we all know and love now. So it's not like they couldn't have done this
story. Literally out on the show. Not, like, insecure security on Barry part, but the whole, like, shallowness and...
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. So... they could have easily done a story, gone in depth story like that for Wally, you know? Maybe they wouldn't have. I mean, people already hated Wally, like, any time that he said anything against Barry, so whatever. No reason not to go further with that. But anyway, Ralph's story was so overwhelming that it threatened to engulf even Barry's story for a second. So, like, that's how much they were willing to invest in Ralph. And meanwhile, when Wally was around, he could get, like, 5 minutes of screen time, maybe an episode, if he was super lucky that week. So... last, and most certainly not least, is Love of My Life, Cisco Ramon, and the only non-black series regular of color. So, also, the most recognizable character from the show, aside from The Flash himself, I would say. Now, when the writers were asked to list their favorite characters to write for, more than half of them put down Cisco. But you don't ever see that on screen. Like, you would never believe that more than half of the writers have Cisco as their favorite. Because we know for a fact that more than half of Cisco's best lines are ad-libs by Carlos. So it's not like they're writing him the best material. Not to mention that the character almost never gets his own storyline, right? He's always there to cater to the nearest white person. Which maybe is why he's their favorite. I don't know. So, like, either he's Barry's sidekick, right? Giving him advice or, like, one-liners. Or he's Caitlin's shoulder to cry on. Or he's whatever version of Wells' dartboard, right? So... the only time that he had space for his own feelings was 3A, when he was upset with Barry over Dante's death. And people hated it. People hated him for it, and they hated 3A because they thought that it brought down the flat. You know, like, it was like, why are you making your comedic relief character the sad character? I hate this. This is terrible. Because Cisco's not allowed to be anything other than comedic relief. Plus, even Barry could easily dismiss his concerns with, like, well, actually, Cisco, I didn't kill Dante, so... there, whereas he couldn't say anything to Caitlin / Taylor Frost when she's like, ah, you couldn't even save your mom, and no one even cared, right? No one was like, hey, Caitlin, you're an asshole. So there is still a discrepancy. Even though Cisco, like, got that space to be angry, it was like the writers never tried again after that. Like, once that happened, they're like, that was bad, we should never let Cisco do anything. Okay, instead he will just be there to cry about white people or give witty one-liners to white people. He did get, obviously, Cynthia in 3B and 4, season 4, but Cynthia, it's literally like, she shows up, they have cute banter, then she disappears, and the next time she shows up, their relationship is in a different spot. So, like, there was no through line there. The episodes that Cynthia is not in, he may as well not be in a relationship with Cynthia. So, even yeah. Like, the biggest part where he was gonna move, like, leave the team and move Earths, which should have been a huge and, like, revolutionary concept for him, you would never have known that that was happening in the episodes where that wasn't the plot point. Which is kind of like Iris and the secret of Wally, right? Once Francine left and Secret of Wally was kind of like that. Like, the episodes where that wasn't a plot point, you would not have known that that was going on in Iris's brain. So, yeah. They still have a long way to go. And I feel like season 4 was an improvement for the Wests, who are not Wally. So this was improvement for Iris Joe and honorary West Cecile. Season 4 was most definitely not an improvement for Cisco. There we go.
Yeah, I feel like season 4 unfortunately regressed Cisco, or at least didn't really move anything forward for him.
Yeah.
So, obviously, I agree with all of what you said. And before I get into the narrative, I want to bring in fandom and their nitpicking over everything Iris does to the point of it being quite ridiculous. It's like being held to such high standards that she can't do anything but fail in their eyes, and it's because she's black and in a very important role in the show. Meanwhile, Caitlin is forgiven by fandom for everything she's feeling and her shitty storylines and behavior. And I lost my place. They placed her in a victim position, and somehow nothing that happens, even if it's her own actions that she took or that she made and the choices that she made, she's never in the wrong. it's like truly disgusting to watch. And in terms of on screen, the first and second seasons were really hard on Iris, I think, in terms of being able to express her opinion, like you said, or voice her feelings. Mm-hmm. Like she was constantly removed from her own storylines, like when they gave finding out about Wells and gave it to Barry instead. She didn't have an outlet to express herself like Barry did, because she didn't have any friends outside of that. Like, she didn't have her own Team Star Labs, you know? She wasn't allowed to talk about her feelings until completely necessary, and she certainly wasn't going to discuss them with Eddie. Like, her feelings about Barry, for example. So it was, like, even worse when Eddie was told about Barry's secret, but Iris wasn't given the same respect. And like Tati said, Joe was around, but they didn't really have nearly as many heart-to-hearts as Joe did with Barry. And I'd say the first two seasons especially were set up to cater to Barry and Barry only. So when Francine came into the picture and quickly left it, Iris didn't get a chance to mourn her mom, aside from the 10 seconds we got with her and Joe in the hospital after she went to see her for the last time. We didn't see her die on screen. There was no funeral for Francine, even though Flash and funerals have gone hand in hand for at least three seasons. And if Francine was white, I feel like that might have been a completely different story. We didn't get to see much of Iris and Wally talking about their mom either. There was that one shot of Iris crying alone on the stairwell, and I never want to see that again, because it was to the point where no one asked her what was wrong or how she was feeling. And we also never got to see her mourn or talk about Eddie on screen until at least episode 217, and there was a hint of it in 212, and those were all in service of the plot. Mm-hmm. Season 3 was better for Iris, but again, her feelings and value as a human was devalued because it turned into how Barry felt about losing her when she should have had a longer struggle on screen besides like one episode. Season 4, I agree, has been a vast improvement in terms of her expressing herself negatively and having doubts about a lot of things, being able to actually be mad at Barry, which she hasn't been since the end of season 1. So if the show continues that in that vein in season 5, that'd be great, because she'll actually get to voice more of her opinions and feelings. And then Wally is another case where he's introduced and there's immediately tension between him and Barry, which I thought would have been more interesting if it had been between, you know, him and Iris, because Joe got to raise her from infancy and they're actual siblings, but Barry's the white guy, so there has to be tension between them. And then that story wasn't really fleshed out either, and Wally's studies got completely ignored. Then Ralph came onto the show and got the attention Wally should have gotten. So even though I think Keenan asked to leave, his character was still shortchanged, and the goodbyes he got were so lackluster and awful. Like, he's supposed to be a major character, but he said it himself. It's like, he wasn't there, and no one noticed his absence, and that's because the writers neglected him completely. They didn't want anyone above Barry, but that attempt was sadly made with Ralph. So that's, like, not an excuse, except for the fact that Wally's black and Ralph is white. And it seems Barry can try to train everyone except Wally, because that only lasted an episode for him. So, and in terms of Wally's relationship with Jesse, they later made it out to be that Wally felt like she came from a better, smarter family, which is ridiculous, but because she's white and Wells was her dad. So if Jesse wasn't white, you better believe Wally would not be feeling less than. And then for Cisco, we only got to see his family once in season 1, and then his brother at the end of season 2 again, right before they killed him off. And it was less about Cisco than it was as a consequence for Barry flashpointing and to create tension. And like Tati said, no one liked that Cisco was mad at Barry, and Iris wasn't mad at Barry, but it was okay for Caitlin to be mad at Barry and basically blame him for most of the season for her powers, which now looks really dumb because it wasn't caused by a flashpoint to begin with. After that, Cisco hasn't been expressing much of anything except humor in his one-liners. Like, they gave him a romantic storyline, but Cynthia wasn't around much for him to grow, and so that development really kind of went nowhere. So he's just too busy, like Tati said, being a shoulder to lean on for Wells and Caitlin. And speaking of Caitlin, they're really close, but the friendship isn't exactly balanced. Like, I think she tends to get more support than she gives. Mm-hmm. And that's true of everyone she interacts with. She's been there for Cisco, but not as much as he was for her. And Wells is always there in Caitlin's corner, but he's not really in Cisco's corner. And now Ralph will be in Caitlin's corner as well, helping her out. So they even had a scene with her and Joe just so she could tell him about Killer Frost, and he could be that listening ear she needed. Like, Iris was also there for her in season 3 and 4 with regards to Killer Frost and helping her out. The only one who isn't really there for her like everyone else is usually Barry, and so her getting so much from everyone else is a narrative compensating for what and has never and will never have.
Yeah, that was the basis for my whole, you know, compensation theory in the first place, just because Caitlin will never have, like, Barry as her everything, they overcompensate by giving her every other character in the Arrowverse, basically. And I feel like going back to your point on the audience forgiving Caitlin for so much of the bad stuff that she does, it's kind of like, you know, going back to that whole, you know, the AI cannot follow the black person around but knows exactly where the white person is at all times. It's like with Caitlin, if she does something that is objectively bad, mm-hmm. the audience already has her in their mind as like she's not fitting in this role that we wanted her to be in, and so this does not compute. So how do we make this compute? And they make up all of these excuses for why she's not actually doing the bad thing. She's actually doing this thing because she's hurt, because da 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 da, and they'll go off and on about it. So, like, if you think about what, I think Allison Williams is her name, when she had that interview about her character from Get Out, mm-hmm. and her character on Get Out is, objectively a villain and a bad white person, and she said that she could not understand why all these people, whenever they see her out, they're always asking her, so, isn't she really a victim? You know, they were trying to, like, come up in their mind some kind of way to make Allison Williams' character not actually be as horrible of a person that she actually was, because she was a pretty white woman in the mm-hmm. movie. And so it's kind of, you know, listening or seeing Allison in that interview, it was crazy to her, like, why people couldn't understand that she is evil. mm-hmm. And, you know, it just doesn't compute in their mind. Like, how do I make this white woman not be the evil person? And they do all these, like, backflips and cartwheels to make it fit into this one narrative in their mind that is not in actuality what's actually happening. And I feel like that happens for Caitlin a lot as well. So even if she wants to go full villain, like not even care about anything, mm-hmm. people would still be trying to like do all these backflips to like bring her back into the side that they're comfortable with.
Yeah.
With her being like the nice white lady. And you know, like I said, like the whole reason that this got me like thinking about this first place, if you look at episode 409 with how many characters reacted to Caitlin having a pity party about herself versus Iris struggling to make an important decision, leadership decision, and not knowing what to do, it's really clear, because she had, like, Caitlin had, no joke, like, four different people in the same episode tell her what a special snowflake that she was. Mm-hmm. Especially, like, if you look at how Harry treated Caitlin versus how Harry treated Iris in that same episode.
Yep.
You know, it's pretty obvious. And, like, for The Flash in general, the writers made the decision to cast a black woman as the romantic lead. And it's a great move towards more, like, inclusivity and diversity in media. However, there's, like, an internal bias in the writer's room, plus the external bias / racism from comic fandom. And that kind of colors how I think the writers write for Iris, especially in the beginning, and their need to compensate fandom for not giving them the traditional white love story mm-hmm. that fandom wanted, respectively. So, firstly, like, with the writing for Iris, like, Tati pretty much nailed us on the head on them, like, never showing us Iris' emotional thought process. And partly, I think, you know, whether this is AJK's toxicity or whatever, part of it, I think, has to do with Barry being painted as the center of the universe in season one. So everything had to revolve around Barry, and there was no space for anything outside of that. So even if she was white, I don't think the writers would have delved more into Iris' feelings.
Right.
However, they wouldn't have had to, because mm-hmm. the audience would be like, oh, she's clearly da-da-da-da-da.
Exactly. The audience would be primed to feel, to know what she's feeling, yeah.
Feel for white Iris that they did not give the benefit of doubt to Candace as Iris. Audience really isn't really used to identifying with women of color in general, or black women specifically, and so because of that, like, the writers were still writing her as quote-unquote white Iris in the sense that they didn't really feel like they needed to compensate for the audience not being able to pick up on what this black woman was feeling in this situation. Mm-hmm. So that, I think that is, like, one part of it. And then also, you know, like I said, the fact once it moved into Barry being with Iris, I think 2A was probably like the worst as far as not giving Iris any space whatsoever. And of course, that was the time that most of the audience were just like loved her because she was never on the screen.
Mm-hmm.
But once they moved into this space of Barry and Iris is a ship, and this is what we're doing. I think it helps Iris in the sense that the way that the writers wrote her was because they cared about Barry so much as a lead, and so that elevated her writing once they got together. But also with Caitlin, the compensation, we're not going to give you this love story, but, you know, we still feel like she's an important character that's, you know, popular for y'all, so we're going to give y'all Caitlin telling her feelings to everybody else, and everybody else coming and supporting her. And because everybody else is propping up Caitlin, there's no one else to prop up Iris, even when Barry's not around. And there's no one to prop up Sisko or any other character because everyone's attention is focused on Caitlin because Caitlin doesn't have Barry's attention. Mm-hmm. So that's how that triangle works. As far as Wally and Sisko, I think, versus Ralph, how Ralph is treated. I think y'all made up some good points about Wally and versus Ralph, and I think that I agree with you that the story and the amount of space that Ralph had was the story that Wally should have had as far as coming up into his powers and, mm-hmm. you know, either feeling overconfident about them and like he didn't need help or stretching Barry's mentoring capacity and patience to mm-hmm. help Wally develop his powers was given to Ralph. And I think that, you know, Wally's goodbye, like we said, it was more outside of the writers, but the writers weren't doing anything with mm-hmm. Wally narrative to begin with. And I feel like the way that they wrote it, I don't know if they were like subconsciously telling on themselves that they didn't care about Wally, so let us write this shitty goodbye that none of the other characters care about Wally either.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that just could have been subconscious Freudian slip. From
yes, I feel that a bit.
How they felt Wally.
Mm-hmm.
But even with Sisko, like you guys said, like he his last comprehensive storyline, I would say even is before the Dante death thing, but it was like in season 2 when he was struggling with his powers. Like that whole, he came into his powers and that's the end of his story. And he's never like progressed mm-hmm. further from that. And he's only there for one-liners. He's kind of like in the same cheerleader category as Diggle, as in the sense that he is at his highest in popularity when he's funny
mm-hmm.
and when he's supporting Barry or supporting Caitlin or supporting Wells or supporting someone else. There's not really much room for him as a person in his own storylines,
mm-hmm.
whereas Ralph is the same kind of, you know, not, Sisko's not abrasive, but also, like, Ralph has all these one-liners, and Ralph has all this, you know, same kind of, like, energy.
Yes. But he got the story to go with it.
So much space and so much story to take up with it. Like, they have never done that for Sisko. Like, mm-hmm. it's just empty or shallow. And, like, it is funny that half the writers think that Sisko is their favorite character when 80% of the stuff that they like about Sisko is stuff that Carlos ad-libs.
Yep.
So, how is that really, like, your favorite character? And then you don't even give him stories
mm-hmm.
to go with that, to develop him, or to do anything about it. Yeah, Ralph gets a lot more. Ralph is Sisko with story.
Yeah.
Basically.
Yeah.
And, like, Sisko doesn't even really get any compensation for it. So
no, he does not.
There's nothing outside of that. So, and even going into season 5, like, if, like we mentioned up at the top of the podcast with Carlos at San Diego Comic-Con and being mm-hmm. a little bit salty the whole time, I'd be salty too if I didn't have a storyline going into, like, 5 seasons in. I'm still being a prop to someone else's storyline.
Right.
And I feel like that's all that the writers, they see him as like a funny gag.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of just thought about this off the top of my head. We might cut it out. But you know how like old movies with either blackface or they have like the black actors that were all that kind of like shuck and jive
mm-hmm.
kind of tap dancing. I feel like that's kind of how they treat
Sisko,
because he's always doing a tap dance. He's always mm-hmm. being that fun, kind of one-liner, but it's never, there's, they've done a lot of time in depth with him like they should. And I think the deepest that they got, and I don't even think they spent a lot of time focusing on his feelings over Dante, other than he was just upset at Barry.
Yeah.
But like his fear about his powers and then his relationship with Cynthia were probably the deepest that they went, but they were also very kind of short-lived story arcs, and there's not a lot of follow-through with that, which is kind of an unfortunate thing for him.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, if they have him express more emotion regarding Cynthia and the breakup and all that, I would really be surprised, besides the whole, oh, I'm sad, let's just take you out and then leave it at that.
Right.
It's going to be interesting to see in season 5 what they plan on doing with that, since they are obviously not trying to bring Cynthia back anytime soon, how to work through that and how that affects him, or if they will show any of that, or will it just be a platform for Ralph to do his Ralph thing in hopes of cheering Cisco up?
Yeah.
So... And then, like you already said about with Joe, so I won't really go that much into it. But yeah, that whole "Do you have a daughter, Joe?" Dark times. Because he was only there to serve Barry and to prop up Barry and to, like, that's literally all he did in season 1.
Yep.
And a little bit into season 2.
And I feel like the only reason there's less of that now is because, well, Jesse L. Martin isn't around as much, and also Iris is there for him.
Yes, so. Iris, cheerleader, yeah. So, the Flash is guilty of being very shallow in how they treat their characters of color, because there are no writers of color in the writer's room to flesh out those feelings or to point out to their coworkers when, you know, people, we should go a little bit deeper into this, or you probably shouldn't say that, or anything like that. So,
and this is why we want less of Wells.
Yes. Less of Wells, and we want black women in the writer's room.
Yes.
Finally, the last case on our docket is Legends of Tomorrow, which is an ensemble show that has a few characters of color. And possibly a mixed bag of how we feel about those, how writers treat those characters. So, ladies, what are your thoughts?
Well, yes, Legends is similar to Flash and that has a nice amount of diversity. And the writer's room also has some nice diversity. But if you look under the surface, if you look under the hood, it's not always properly utilized. And we can go back to season 1 when they were far more guilty of these crimes, but Kendra in season 1 was a genuine example of an undercooked, underwritten character whose only purpose was to be a love interest or to be a prize for men. Like, aka what people said was true of Iris, but was actually true of Kendra. So she fell for, like, Carter and Ray off screen somehow. You know, like, both of those dynamics developed off screen, even though she was supposed to be, you know, fated to be with Carter from the start. And those different dynamics ruled her entire storyline, as well as Vandal Savage's obsession with her, right? Something that she didn't even get to be really involved in or a part of. Just, like, he just loved her, the passive object. So this was all resolved in whatever haphazard way, and then she was shipped off at the end of the season 1 and then never mentioned again. So, like, that was, like, literally the worst possible writing for her, is what she got. And then we have Jax, who is Stein's other half, and came on board the Legends by being kidnapped against his will. But that's okay, because Stein is a nice, lovable old white man, so we're not actually upset with him. And even though Jax was the one basically keeping the Wave Rider running most of the time, his talents never actually received, like, the respect or the space that they deserved, and he never got his own individual storyline. His biggest storyline was about how he would be nothing without Stein. And then that came true when Stein died, and Jax was like, well, I guess I have to leave now because I am nothing without Stein. And then he, like, came back for an episode just to showcase all this, like, imaginary growth and, like, lifestyle changes. Like, he's like, hey, guess what? I'm successful doing something and I got married and I have a kid or something like that. And I was like, what? What? Okay. Bye, Jax. So this is also really bad, super shallow writing for their only black male character up to that point, We will get to that later. But in season two, they introduced Amaya, who I would say has been written and has been given, you know, just leaps and bounds better than Jax and Kendra. Perhaps because she's...
Because she's tied to Nate.
Yes! Because she is tied to Nate, a white man, so she got a little bit of an upgrade story-wise. But it also chains her down as a character, right? It's something that the Shredder himself even said, that he felt bad that they tied Maisie to Nate for so much of her storyline. And he said this in front of Nick Zano, too, and I was like, this is so strange. But anyway, so...
He probably knows that she was better than Nate.
Yeah. So she's beholden to this destiny. And the thing is that, like, Amaya's beholden to this destiny that's in her future, right? It's not even in her past, it's in her future. But no one else on the ship is beholden to something in their future, you know? Hell, other characters were changing their past. Like, Mick changed his dynamic with his father when he met him in that one episode. Y'all know what I'm talking about.
Yes, the Vietnam episode.
And then he, like, managed to convince his father to see things a different way. So that means that Mick, unaware of himself, he's having a different life, you know? But whatever. Amaya can't do that for some reason. So she kept having to go back to, like, destiny and, like, oh, everything that she did was like, oh, am I going to make babies with Nate? Or am I going to make babies with some other dude that we never even meet? And then we also have, you know, compare her dynamic, her off-screen dynamic with one granddaughter, like, the good granddaughter, and then her dynamic with Kuasa to, like, Damien and Nora, right? Damien and Nora are both villains of season three, but they get, like, these, like, long, fleshed-out arc, and, like, Damien changes, you get the whole course of his change, right? Before he sacrifices himself for Nora, or whatever. And then, on the other hand, you've got Kuasa, who showed up, like, four times, and Amaya was, like, mostly mean to her. And Kuasa was mean too, but that's okay. So like there wasn't any like depth or like interest. Like you could tell that like, they weren't invested in that dynamic. Just like we've mentioned previously when we talk about Amaya and Zari, like they're connected by their totems, but the writers didn't really care about exploring what that meant. Like why are they connected by these totems? How does that change their relationship? Like, you know, how close are they really? So we never really get into these kinds of stuff with Amaya. And then the most, like, I would say that, like, as much as I'm glad that Maisie's gonna come back, and I think it's kind of cool that, Phil Klemmer said that he wanted to bring her back as Charlie because he loved so much of, like, Maisie's actual personality that he wanted to give her some of that on the show. Like, to be able to, you know, just send Amaya away and then bring her back as, like, not even, like, it's not even, like, Amaya 2, right? It's not like, even the Laurel situation. It's, like, a totally different character named Charlie now. Like, that's just, like, the height of, like, the character being disposable, you know? Like, well, we'll keep the actress, but now you're just gonna be a totally new person, because why not? And, like, he compared it to Rip Hunter, and, like, how he was that, like, director or whatever in season two, but that was still Rip. Like, Rip was being brainwashed, you know? Rip's memories were taken from him, and then he was restored to himself before he heroically died. So, like, they still didn't change the essence of Rip. Whereas this is definitely, like, we don't even need Amaya, we can just have Charlie. Speaking of being disposable, as soon as Jax left, they were like, but we have Wally! So they brought Wally on, who's also an engineer, but at the same time, his family history and his personality were kind of revamped for his appearance on Legends. So suddenly he has no confidence in his engineering, and he just, like, feels like his family, like, doesn't appreciate him, or, like, the Team Flash didn't appreciate him, which is, like, kind of a dig at the actual Flash show itself, because it was the writers who did not appreciate him, not the characters. But then to say, oh, we're gonna appreciate you here, Wally, we're gonna care about, you know, your talents, and we're gonna treat you with respect, and then to have him, like, dude bro talking with Nate, like, calling Amaya a bitch, you know, the way he spoke to imaginary Jesse was, like, super not Wally. Like, Wally wouldn't do these things. I don't understand what's happening right now. This is not Wally. And now he's disappearing from that show without a goodbye, which, again, is not Legend's fault, but is also a sign of how he wasn't valued there, even though his storyline was literally, we are going to value you. So, yeah. And then finally, there's Zari, who I would say probably has gotten the best treatment so far. She's only been around for a season, but she has had, like, her own centric episodes, and they delved into her backstory, and they, you know, even had her talking about Ramadan. So I would say, like, the only thing that I would question about that is, as already mentioned, they didn't go deeper in that dynamic with Amaya, like, when they could have invested something in that, and they didn't. And then also, like, the episode where she's actually fasting, they paired her with Mick, who's, like, the most disrespectful character. And then at the end of it, he doesn't even, like, learn a lesson about respect. It was just like, oh, okay, that's nice. I will continue to be disrespectful. And that was just the end of that. And also, they didn't really resolve the brother arc. And when I asked if it's going to come back next season, the writer, Keto Shimizu, she said that it would return thematically. I don't know what that means, but it doesn't sound like it will return and she will save her brother or not save her brother and have feelings about it. So I feel like it's very different from Sarah's, say, season-long quest to deal with her sister's death. Hmm. So there you go.
Yeah. I mean, for me, I feel like they weren't really committed to Kendra as a character, and I think they were more in love with the idea of her storyline than they were with her. And by the end of the season, she became sadly disposable as a character because of how they left it off, and no one ever really brought her up again, which was weird. And even when she was on the show, it was just like a rehash of the same thing over and over, and the narrative didn't really develop her, nor did she really get much in the way of support for her with regards to like any feelings she may have had or anything like that. It was just all of the plot. And then Jax was really disrespected on the show when looking back. Not only did he start off on The Flash by being told by Caitlin that he wasn't good enough to be the white man's other half, but then when he went off to Legends, he didn't even want to be there, and later down the line told Stuck that he's grateful to him, even though he was forced to be on the Waverider at first. It was a weird power play, and then in the first season, he liked Kendra, but of course only the white men could have her, so please think of me eye-rolling in this instant, even though you can't see me. And like Taji said, he never had a storyline of his own in comparison to the white guys on the ship, and his entire existence was tied to Stein to the point that he spent half a season talking about him leaving, and even then his expression of emotion was fine, but it only happened because it involved his white counterpart. So, like, if Jax was the one leaving, Stein wouldn't necessarily feel the same way. Like, Stein's decision was his own, but he never offered the same choice to Jax when he brought him onto the Waverider. So it's all just flimsy and disrespectful given the fact that they were supposed to be partners. And then Wally's addition onto the Waverider was hoped to be good for him given his treatment on season 4 of The Flash, but then his character ended up regressing and had a much lower self-worth than he did on The Flash, which is really weird. And I already mentioned the Flash section about Jesse, but why the fact and the fact that they brought her in so that Wally can get shit on was pretty terrible. Like, even the Wests were brought down to, and the show made it seem like he wasn't loved when Joe and Iris obviously loved him very much. And compared that to the way the white characters were treated in terms of their family and how they got to flesh it out without making them suffer for being less than they actually were. So, like, Sarah and her relationship with her family is the best comparison because she also started on another show, and she's given time to sort through her feelings without making it out to be like she was ignored or disrespected by her family and her exes and everybody else. So, like, Wally not appearing during the fourth season of Legends and not even for a goodbye says a lot about how his time on the Waverider was ultimately viewed by the writers, and especially since Wally himself said he felt like he finally found a place where he belonged. So, that's weird. And Amaya...
that is weird.
Amaya was treated pretty well. Most of the time. Sometimes. But there were still issues. She wasn't given enough of a chance to talk about her destiny or interact with her granddaughter, like you said, and wonder why she had to fulfill this destiny to begin with. Like, why did she have to succumb to some pre-written future when all the other characters had to? Why does the destiny stuff tie only the black women to their fates on this show while everyone else is allowed to prosper and say fuck the timeline? So, like, take Nate, for example, who got to whine and complain about Amaya for a while she didn't question it, nor did she react to his comments, and then took him back. He's a time historian, or, you know, whatever he started off to be, but then never did he once think that the future and the past should stay intact because of destiny. And then Damian and Nora were allowed to interact far more than Amaya and Kuasa, which was off balance, and the answer is because, you know, they're white, and as such, there's an unconscious bias with the way they're written and how they flesh out their backgrounds and familial problems. And yes, like Tati said, Amaya's story was too tied in with Nate, and a lot of her story ended up being about how could she leave him and all of that stuff. So it just wasn't, like, as fleshed out as it could be. Whereas if it was, like, Sarah, it probably would have. And I agree that Zari's treated far better in comparison to the others, but at the same time, they did seem to forget about her family, and she doesn't talk about her brother unless it's in reference to her wanting to save him. So, like, what was their relationship like? Why aren't there any flashbacks to her life before the Wave Rider? Sarah still struggles over Laurel, but we at least got to see her relationship and still see them interact to some capacity, whether it's in a memory or, like, E2 Laurel, but Zari isn't afforded the same luxury. She also could benefit more from heart... Sorry. She also could benefit from more heart-to-hearts.
Mm-hmm.
And in terms of the Ramadan scenes she had with Mick, that was completely disrespectful to me, especially since she is the first Muslim-American character in the Arrowverse, so they could have let her have this moment with one of the other characters instead of the one white guy who also happens to be the least sensitive.
Mm-hmm.
Like, she was talking about her religion and culture and her memories of her family in that instance, but it wasn't treated like it mattered. It was something to be mocked and belittled, and I didn't like that at all. It was just like a peek into her background, and the legends disrespected that.
Are you done?
Yeah.
Are you done? I was like, okay, you're done.
Finally, I'm done.
Oh, okay. I wasn't sure. I thought
it was the end.
Period. Full stop. I was also thinking, so I was like half paying attention. In terms of Legends of Tomorrow, I didn't know season one because I don't know Kendra. Really, barely speak to how she was treated, and I wasn't really feeling Sierra Renee either. But so I can't really speak to that. As far as like Jax, like even like I didn't watch season one, but I know in season one they went to like the 60s or something, and had Jax try to date a white girl.
Mm-hmm.
I remember that. And then they had another in season two, the slavery episode. I'm like, stop putting your black characters in situations meant to harm them and trying to like make out, well, what if this happened? No, that wouldn't happen because he'd be strung up and lynched. I was like, all right, are you putting Jax in a situation that realistically he would never be safe?
Right.
Like, stop doing that. No, we don't want to go down that hypothetical road because that hypothetically would not happen.
Mm-hmm.
So stop it. And like you guys said, the fact that he never really had a storyline outside of Stein, and you can kind of argue that it's because they shared the same hero, same body or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the frustrating thing this past season was that so much of the first half of season three or four. What season are we on with Legends?
Season three was last season.
The first half of season three was all about trying to figure out who he is on his own without Stein, and if he could be a hero, stay on the Wave Rider. And you go through this process, and even that same episode that you mentioned with Mick, Vietnam episode where Mick is off reconnecting with his dad, Jax has that heroic moment where he himself is able to save the president, and you think, ah, yes. Now he knows that he can still be on the Wave Rider, even if he's not, you know, one half of Firestorm. And then as soon as he, like, Stein dies, then Jack's like, well, no, I gotta go. Like, even though I went through all of this, you know, processing for 8 episodes on who I could be and if I could do this, and I found out, yes, I can, I decided that I don't want to. And so, like, what was the point of doing all of that and going through all of that? And then with Amaya, I feel like Amaya was written to be very passive about a lot of things that happened to her. Like, everything happened to Amaya. Like, Amaya was never really allowed to be proactive in her destiny. Mm-hmm. At the time, so it's very, like, reactive, and it's very, like, passive. I think in her relationship with Nate, it was very passive. Nate pursued her, and Amaya was like, okay. And then Nate was like, well, we can't fall in love. And I was like, okay. But Nate was like, but I really love you. And Amaya was like, okay. And then they break up because she has, you know, she's worried about destiny.
Mm-hmm.
And then Nate is allowed to say all this kind of stuff because he's in his feelings. And it's just like, okay. Like, she doesn't really have any kind of reaction or emotions or feelings. Like, I don't think she really got mad or upset with Nate.
Right.
Soon afterwards, Nate said that he loved her again, and then all of a sudden, you know, Amaya is in love with Nate. And so a lot of her story, I think, was reactive to whether Nate loved or disliked her at the moment, or destiny when, you know, the plot decided that she needed to be worried about that again. And it's kind of weird because not once did they ever question what if Nate was her destiny? Like, that should have been, I still think that should have been, like, a storyline. Mm-hmm. And that would have been Amaya being, like, proactive a little bit in her destiny and trying to figure it out. But they never did that. So I hope to see with Charlie, as a, since this is a completely different character, a completely different way that Maisie is able to play her, that's not so reactive and not so passive, and it is actually, and her being a trickster, I think, could lead into maybe giving her a new story. But, you know, that is to be determined. And I think with Zari as well, like, there's a lot that could have been explored with Amaya and Zari, because they had that connection. I do agree that she was able to have a lot more room being the new character, and I think she was the writer's new favorite this season. That's why she got so much. But you have, like, Zari versus Sarah, and the way that they built up their tension, they kind of, like, ramped it up for that one Groundhog's Day episode and kind of resolved it. And you see that, like, especially with, you know, when he was paired with Zari in the Ramadan episode, where she's trying to talk to it, to him about it, and kind of...
Where Mick was paired with Zari?
Mick was paired with Zari. Mm-hmm. Like, when she's talking about the Ramadan, he was just like, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And I think part of that, like, his disrespect and not willing to learn anything about Zari's culture was partly just because the writers... Like, oh, isn't that so funny that he's such an uncultured brute, blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
He gets so much latitude. It feels like Dominic Purcell is even lazy in portraying Mick. Like, I'm not sure that he wants to be there half the time. Mick certainly doesn't want to be where he is half the time. And yet the writers continue to write him all over the place. In the same way they write Nate. Like, Nate was their favorite child in season, what did he come in, season two?
Season two, yeah.
Yeah. Favorite child by far, and gets so much space in the narrative. Even with Amaya's story, half her story was encompassed by, like, Nate and Nate's feelings. So that, I feel like that's a little bit of an issue. And as far as, like, with Wally coming in, and you guys said it already, with the fact that the whole rewriting of Wally's personality is because Legends of Writers were, like, you know, partly taking a dig at the Flash for not taking care of Wally, but then they don't take care of Wally either, because Wally never really had a storyline on Legends while he was there. And, you know, they didn't really know what to do with him, and they didn't really understand him as a character, and now he's not going to be there next season, and they're not really going to explain it, so... You know, you played yourself, Legends writers. Better. Better at all. So that, you know, the Legends is found guilty of of what? Not caring about their character colors when they said they should.
Yeah.
Basically, I think. Anything else to add about that? What else were they found guilty of?
Maybe not giving them as much active, or having them be more active in their own storylines.
There you go. Legends writers are guilty of not giving their character colors more agency, more activeness in their own stories. So, that's where we're going to wrap it up. We could include Black Lightning, but Black Lightning is, like...
Doing it right?
Yeah, and this is an entire character... cast of color, minus one white guy, and I guess Cyanide, written by writers and producers of color.
Right.
So,
yeah,
black cast, black writers.
Exactly. The only thing I would say about Black Lightning is that that goes to show, like, the way they treat Gambi, you know? He gets as much space, he gets as much complexity and nuance as any white man would on any white show, because black people... People of color are conditioned to empathize with white people. That's the default. Yeah. So anyone can write white people.
Yeah, and I would say that you can even, going in with Gambi, and this is more on Phantom, and it could just be just Phantom's you know, intolerance of women in general, but the whole Gambi versus Lynn in season, first season, especially in the beginning of the first season, when Gambi was on Jefferson's side and Lynn was on the opposing side. Mm-hmm. Lynn was the antagonist, and fandom didn't really understand Lynn's perspective.
Yeah.
This is like, you know, Black Lightning fandom. You've got a large Black fandom, but even within a Black show and a Black fan base, it's still very difficult to prioritize this Black woman's emotions around a subject.
Mm-hmm.
She's paired against a white man that agreed or had his own agenda to support the Black hero or the protagonist of the show.
Yeah. And I would even argue, and I don't know if you guys would agree with this, but Gambi has a pretty... He's gotten to interact with several characters outside of the Pierce family, whereas I feel like Lynn hasn't.
Right.
And so he kind of gets a bigger world in terms of, you know,
true.
His past and
true.
And who he's been friends with or has worked with versus, like, other characters.
Yeah, and that could just be, like, you know, men in general prioritize over women kind of thing,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Lynn is defined by being a mother, mm-hmm. and that's about it.
Yeah. Yeah, I was going to say, because Gambi has a backstory outside of the Pierce family. It still connects back to the Pierce family, but he has a Black backstory with the bad guys, whose names I cannot really remember, whereas Lynn's only backstory so far is with Jefferson.
Right.
Yep.
So, that concludes our kind of discussion on racial bias within writers' room, within fandom, particularly within the DC TV fandom, things that we think could be improved upon, especially when taking care of writing characters of color on shows. Thanks for joining us. If you have any thoughts or questions or comments about any of the shows, and if you agree, if you disagree, if we missed something that we should have brought up, because there's so much that yep. you could probably bring up as examples, and you want to talk to us about it, you can reach us on Twitter at DCTVGumption. You can send us email ladieswgumption@gmail.com or send us ask on Tumblr. And we will see you next week. I'm not sure what we're talking about next week, but we will be here.
We'll figure it out.
Yeah. Yes, we will.
All right.
Bye.